Part 2. The Theory of Desirable Difficulty. I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." 2 Corinthians 12:7-10. Chapter 4. David Boies. You wouldn't wish dyslexia on your child, or would you? 1. If you do a brain scan on a person with dyslexia, the images that are produced seem strange. In certain critical parts of the brain, those that deal with reading and processing words, dyslexics have less gray matter. They don't have as many brain cells in those regions as they should. As the fetus develops inside the womb, neurons are supposed to travel to the appropriate areas of the brain, taking their places like pieces on a chessboard. But for some reason, the neurons of dyslexics sometimes get lost along the way. They end up in the wrong place. The brain has something called the ventricular system, which functions as the brain's entry and exit point. Some people with reading disorders have neurons lining their ventricles like passengers stranded in an airport. While an image of the brain is being made, patients perform a task, and then a neuroscientist looks to see what parts of their brain have been activated in response to that task. If you ask a dyslexic to read when he or she is having a brain scan, the parts that are supposed to light up might not light up at all. The scan looks like an aerial photo of a city during a blackout. Dyslexics use a lot more of the right hemisphere of their brain during reading than normal readers do. The right hemisphere is the conceptual side. That's the wrong half of the brain for a precise and rigorous task like reading. Sometimes, when a dyslexic reads, every step will be delayed, as if the different parts of the brain responsible for reading were communicating via a weak connection. One of the ways to test for the presence of dyslexia in a small child is to have him engage in rapid, automatized naming. Show him one color after another, a red dot, then a green dot, then a blue dot, then a yellow dot, and check his response. See the color, recognize the color, attach a name to the color, say the name. That's automatic in most of us. It's not in someone with a reading disorder. Somewhere along the way, the links between those 4 steps start to break down. Ask a 4-year-old, "Can you say the word banana without the ba?" Or say, "Listen to the following 3 sounds. Ka, a, ta. Can you combine them into cat?" Or take cat, hat, and dark. Which of those words doesn't rhyme? Easy questions for most 4-year-olds. Really hard questions for dyslexics. Many people used to think that what defines dyslexics is that they get their words backwards. Cat would be tack, or something like that, making it sound like dyslexia is a problem in the way that words are seen. But it is much more profound than that. Dyslexia is a problem in the way people hear and manipulate sounds. The difference between ba and da is a subtlety in the first 40 milliseconds of the syllable. Human language is based on the assumption that we can pick up that 40 millisecond difference, and the difference between the ba sound and the da sound can be the difference between getting something right and getting something catastrophically wrong. Can you imagine the consequences of having a brain so sluggish that when it comes to putting together the building blocks of words, those crucial 40 milliseconds simply go by too quickly? If you have no concept of the sounds of language, if you take away a letter, if you take away a sound, and you don't know what to do, then it's really hard to map the sounds to the written counterparts, Nadine Gobb, a dyslexia researcher at Harvard, explains. It may take you a while to learn to read. You read really slowly, which then impairs your reading fluency, which then impairs your reading comprehension because you're so slow that by the time you're at the end of the sentence, you've forgotten what the beginning of the sentence was. So it leads to all these problems in middle school or high school. Then it starts affecting all other subjects in school. You can't read. How are you going to do on math tests that have a lot of writing in them? Or how do you take an exam in social studies if it takes you 2 hours to read what they want from you? Usually you get a diagnosis at 8 or 9, she went on, and we find that by that point there are already a lot of serious psychological implications, because by that point you've been struggling for 3 years. Maybe you were the cool kid on the playground when you were 4. Then you entered kindergarten and all your peers suddenly started reading and you can't figure it out. So you get frustrated. Your peers may think you're stupid. Your parents may think you're lazy. You have very low self-esteem, which leads to an increased rate of depression. Kids with dyslexia are more likely to end up in the juvenile system because they act up. It's because they can't figure things out. It's so important in our society to read. You wouldn't wish dyslexia on a child of yours. Or would you? 2. So far in David and Goliath, we've looked at the ways in which we are often misled about the nature of advantages. Now it is time to turn our attention to the other side of the ledger. What do we mean when we call something a disadvantage? Conventional wisdom holds that a disadvantage is something that ought to be avoided, that it is a setback or a difficulty that leaves you worse off than you would be otherwise. But that is not always the case. In the next few chapters, I want to explore the idea that there are such things as desirable difficulties. That concept was coined by Robert Bjork and Elizabeth Bjork, two psychologists of the University of California, Los Angeles, and it is a beautiful and haunting way of understanding how underdogs come to excel. Consider, for example, the following puzzle. A bat and a ball cost $1.10 in total. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? What's your instinctive response? I'm guessing that it is that the ball must cost 10 cents. That can't be right, though, can it? The bat is supposed to cost $1 more than the ball. So if the ball costs 10 cents, the bat must cost $1.10, and we've exceeded our total. The right answer must be that the ball costs 5 cents. Here's another question. If it takes 5 machines 5 minutes to make 5 widgets, how long would it take 100 machines to make 100 widgets? The setup of the question tempts you to answer 100, but it's a trick. 100 machines take exactly the same amount of time to make 100 widgets as 5 machines take to make 5 widgets. The right answer is 5 minutes. These puzzles are 2 of the 3 questions that make up the world's shortest intelligence test. It's called the Cognitive Reflection Test, CRT. It was invented by the Yale professor Shane Frederick, and it measures your ability to understand when something is more complex than it appears, to move past impulsive answers to deeper, analytical judgments. Frederick argues that if you want a quick way to sort people according to their level of basic cognitive ability, his little test is almost as useful as tests that have hundreds of items and take several hours to finish. To prove his point, Frederick gave the CRT to students at 9 American colleges, and the results track pretty closely with how students from those colleges would rank on more traditional intelligence tests. Students from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, perhaps the brainiest college in the world, averaged 2.18 correct answers out of 3. Students at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, another extraordinarily elite institution, averaged 1.51 right answers out of 3. Harvard students scored 1.43, the University of Michigan Ann Arbor 1.18, and the University of Toledo 0.57. The CRT is really hard. But here's the strange thing. Do you know the easiest way to raise people's scores on the test? Make it just a little bit harder. The psychologists Adam Alter and Daniel Oppenheimer tried this a few years ago with a group of undergraduates at Princeton University. First, they gave the CRT the normal way, and the students averaged 1.9 correct answers out of 3. That's pretty good, though it is well short of the 2.18 that MIT students averaged. Then Alter and Oppenheimer printed out the test questions in a font that was really hard to read. The average score this time around? 2.45. Suddenly, the students were doing much better than their counterparts at MIT. That's strange, isn't it? Normally, we think that we are better at solving problems when they are presented clearly and simply. But here, the opposite happened. The kind of font that Alter and Oppenheimer used makes reading really frustrating. You have to squint a little bit and maybe read the sentence twice, and you probably wonder halfway through who on earth thought it was a good idea to print out the test this way. Suddenly, you have to work to read the question. Yet all that extra effort pays off. As Alter says, making the questions disfluent causes people to think more deeply about whatever they come across. They'll use more resources on it. They'll process more deeply or think more carefully about what's going on. If they have to overcome a hurdle, they'll overcome it better when you force them to think a little harder. Alter and Oppenheimer made the CRT more difficult, but that difficulty turned out to be desirable. Not all difficulties have a silver lining, of course. What Carolyn Sachs went through in her organic chemistry class at Brown was an undesirable difficulty. She is a curious, hardworking, talented student who loves science, and there was no advantage in putting her in a situation where she felt demoralized and inadequate. The struggle did not give her a new appreciation of science. It scared her away from science. But there are times and places where struggles have the opposite effect, where what seems like the kind of obstacle that ought to cripple an underdog's chances is actually like Alter and Oppenheimer's difficult font. Can dyslexia turn out to be a desirable difficulty? It's hard to believe that it can, given how many people struggle with the disorder throughout their lives. Except for a strange fact. An extraordinarily high number of successful entrepreneurs are dyslexic. A recent study by Julie Logan at City University London puts the number somewhere around a third. The list includes many of the most famous innovators of the past few decades. Richard Branson, the British billionaire entrepreneur, is dyslexic. Charles Schwab, the founder of the discount brokerage that bears his name, is dyslexic, as are the cell phone pioneer Craig McCaw, David Neeleman, the founder of JetBlue, John Chambers, the CEO of the technology giant Cisco, Paul Orfila, the founder of Kinko's, to name just a few. The neuroscientist Sharon Thompson-Schill remembers speaking at a meeting of prominent university donors, virtually all of them successful business people, and on a whim, asking how many of them had ever been diagnosed with a learning disorder. Half the hands went up, she said. It was unbelievable. There are two possible interpretations for this remarkable fact. One is that this extraordinary group of people triumphed in spite of their disability, that they are so smart and so creative that nothing, not even a lifetime of struggling with reading, could stop them. The second, more intriguing possibility is that they succeeded in part because of their disorder, that they learned something in their struggle that proved to be of enormous advantage. Would you wish dyslexia on your child? If the second of these possibilities is true, you just might. 3. David Boies grew up in farming country in rural Illinois. He was the eldest of five. His parents were public school teachers. His mother would read to him when he was young. He would memorize what she said because he couldn't follow what was on the page. He didn't begin to read until the third grade, and then only did so slowly and with great difficulty. Many years later, he would realize that he had dyslexia, but at the time, he didn't think he had a problem. His little town in rural Illinois wasn't a place that regarded reading well as some crucial badge of achievement. Many of his classmates quit school to work on the farm the first chance they got. Boies read comic books, which were easy to follow and had lots of pictures. He rarely read for fun. Even today, he might read a book a year, if that. He watches television, anything he says with a laugh that moves and is in color. His speaking vocabulary is limited. He uses small words and short sentences. Sometimes, if he's reading something out loud and runs into a word he doesn't know, he will stop and spell it out slowly. My wife gave me an iPad a year and a half ago, which was my first computer-like device, and one of the things that was interesting is that my attempt to spell many words is not close enough for spell check to find the correct spelling, Boies said. I can't tell you how many times I get the little message that says, no spelling suggestions. When Boys graduated from high school, he didn't have any great ambitions. His grades had been ragged. His family had moved to Southern California by then, and the local economy was booming. He got a job in construction. It was outside work with older guys, Boys remembers. I was making more money than I could ever have imagined. It was a lot of fun. After that, he worked for a while as a bookkeeper in a bank while playing a lot of bridge on the side. It was a great life. I could have gone on like that for a while. But after our first child was born, my wife became increasingly serious-minded about my future. She brought home brochures and pamphlets from local colleges and universities. He remembered a childhood fascination with the law and decided that he would go to law school. Today, David Boies is one of the most famous trial lawyers in the world. How Boies went from a construction worker with a high school education to the top of the legal profession is a puzzle, to say the least. The law is built around reading, around cases and opinions and scholarly analyses, and Boies is someone for whom reading is a chore. It seems crazy that he would even have considered the law. But let's not forget that if you are listening to this book, then you are probably a reader. And that means you've probably never had to think of all the shortcuts and strategies and bypasses that exist to get around reading. Boies started college at the University of Redlands, a small private university an hour east of Los Angeles. Going there was his first break. Redlands was a small pond. Boies excelled there. He worked hard and was very well organized because he knew he had to be. Then he got lucky. Redlands required a number of core courses for graduation, all of which involved heavy reading requirements. In those years, however, one could apply to law school without completing an undergraduate degree. Boies simply skipped the core courses. "I remember when I found out I could go to law school without graduating," he says. "It was so great, I couldn't believe it." Law school, of course, required even more reading. But Boies discovered that there were summaries of the major cases, guides that would boil down the key point of a long Supreme Court opinion to a page or two. "People might tell you that's an undesirable way to do law school," he said, "but it was functional." Plus, he was a good listener. "Listening," he said, "is something I've been doing essentially all my life. I learned to do it because that was the only way I could learn. I remember what people say. I remember words they use." So he would sit in class at law school while everyone else furiously made notes or doodled or lapsed into daydreams or faded in and out, focusing on what was said and committing what he heard to memory. His memory by that point was a formidable instrument. He had been exercising it, after all, ever since his mother read to him as a child and he memorized what she said. His fellow students, as they made notes and doodled and faded in and out, missed things. Their attention was compromised. Boies didn't have that problem. He might not have been a reader, but the things he was forced to do because he could not read well turned out to be even more valuable. He started out at Northwestern Law School, then he transferred to Yale. When Boies became a lawyer, he did not choose to practice corporate law. That would have been foolish. Corporate lawyers need to work their way through mountains of documents and appreciate the significance of the minor footnote on page 367. He became a litigator, a job that required him to think on his feet. He memorizes what he has to say. Sometimes in court, he stumbles when he has to read something and comes across a word that he cannot process in time. So he stops and spells it out, like a child in a spelling bee. It's awkward. It's more of an eccentricity, though, than an actual problem. In the 1990s, he headed the prosecution team accusing Microsoft of antitrust violations, and during the trial he kept referring to login as login with a J, which is just the kind of mistake a dyslexic makes. But he was devastating in the cross-examination of witnesses because there was no nuance, no subtle evasion, no peculiar and telling choice of words that he would miss, and no stray comment or revealing admission from testimony an hour or a day or a week before that he would not have heard, registered, and remembered. "If I could read a lot faster, it would make a lot of things that I do easier," Boies said. "There is no doubt about that. But on the other hand, not being able to read a lot and learning by listening and asking questions means that I need to simplify issues to their basics. And that is very powerful, because in trial cases, judges and jurors, neither of them have the time or the ability to become an expert in the subject. One of my strengths is presenting a case that they can understand. His opponents tend to be scholarly types who have read every conceivable analysis of the issue at hand. Time and again, they get bogged down in excessive detail. Boyce doesn't. One of his most famous cases, Hollingsworth versus Schwarzenegger, involved a California law limiting marriage to a man and a woman. Boyce was the attorney arguing that the law was unconstitutional. And in the trial's most memorable exchange, Boyce destroyed the other side's key expert witness, David Blankenhorn, getting him to concede huge chunks of Boyce's case. One of the things you tell a witness when you're preparing them is take your time, Boyce said, even when you don't need to. Because there will be some times when you need to slow down, and you don't want to show the examiner by your change of pace that this is something you need time on. So, when were you born? He spoke carefully and deliberately. It was 1941. You don't say, it was March 11, 1941 at 6 in the morning, even though you're not trying to hide it. You want your response to be the same for the easy things as for the harder things, so you don't reveal what's easy and what's hard by the way you answer. When Blankenhorn paused just a bit too much in certain crucial moments, Boyce caught it. It was tone and pace and the words he used. Some of it comes from pauses. He'd slow down when he was trying to think of how to phrase something. He was someone who, as you probed him and listened to him, you could hear areas where he was uncomfortable, where he would use an obscuring word. And by being able to zero in on those areas, I was able to get him to admit the key elements of our case. 4. Boyce has a particular skill that helps to explain why he is so good at what he does. He's a superb listener. But think about how he came to develop that skill. Most of us gravitate naturally towards the areas where we excel. The child who picks up reading easily goes on to read even more and becomes even better at it and ends up in a field that requires a lot of reading. A young boy named Tiger Woods is unusually coordinated for his age and finds that the game of golf suits his imagination, and so he likes to practice golf. And because he likes to practice so much, he gets even better, and on in a virtuous circle. That's capitalization learning. We get good at something by building on the strengths that we are naturally given. But desirable difficulties have the opposite logic. In their CRT experiments, Alter and Oppenheimer made students excel by making their lives harder, by forcing them to compensate for something that had been taken away from them. That's what Boyce was doing as well when he learned to listen. He was compensating. He had no choice. He was such a terrible reader that he had to scramble and adapt and come up with some kind of strategy that allowed him to keep pace with everyone around him. Most of the learning that we do is capitalization learning. It is easy and obvious. If you have a beautiful voice and perfect pitch, it doesn't take much to get you to join a choir. Compensation learning, on the other hand, is really hard. Memorizing what your mother says while she reads to you and then reproducing the words later in such a way that sounds convincing to all those around you requires that you confront your limitations. It requires that you overcome your insecurity and humiliation. It requires that you focus hard enough to memorize the words and then have the panache to put on a successful performance. Most people with a serious disability cannot master all those steps. But those who can are better off than they would have been otherwise, because what is learned out of necessity is inevitably more powerful than the learning that comes easily. It is striking how often successful dyslexics tell versions of this same compensation story. It was horrible to be in school, a man named Brian Grazer told me. My body chemistry would always change. I would be anxious, really anxious. It would take forever to do a simple homework assignment. I would spend hours daydreaming because I couldn't really read the words. You'd find yourself sitting in one place for an hour and a half accomplishing nothing. Through 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th grade, I was getting mostly Fs with an occasional D or maybe a C. I was only passing because my mom wouldn't let them put me back. So how did Grazer get through school? Before any test or exam, he would start to plan and strategize, even in elementary school. I would get together with someone the night before, he said. What are you going to do? How do you think you will answer these questions? I'd try and guess the questions, or if there was a way to get the questions of the test beforehand, I would. By the time he'd hit high school, he'd developed a better strategy. I challenged all my grades, he went on, which meant that literally every time I got my grade in high school, after the report cards came out, I would go back to each teacher and do a one-on-one. I would argue my D into a C and my C into a B, and almost every time, 90% of the time, I got my grade changed. I would just wear them down. I got really good at it. I got confident. In college, I would study knowing that I was going to have this hour-long meeting afterwards with my professor. I learned how to do everything possible to sell my point. It was really good training. All good parents try to teach their children the art of persuasion, of course. But a normal, well-adjusted child has no need to take these lessons seriously. If you get A's in school, you never need to figure out how to negotiate your way to a passing grade, or to look around the room as a 9-year-old and start strategizing about how to make it through the next hour. But when Grazer practiced negotiation, just as when boys practiced listening, he had a gun to his head. He practiced day in, day out, year after year. When Grazer said that was, quote, really good training, what he meant was learning to talk this way from a position of weakness to a position of strength turned out to be the perfect preparation for the profession he ended up in. Grazer is now one of the most successful movie producers in Hollywood of the past 30 years. Would Brian Grazer be where he is if he wasn't a dyslexic? 5. Let's dig a little deeper into this strange association between what is essentially a neurological malfunction and career success. In the Big Pond chapter, I talked about the fact that being on the outside in a less elite and less privileged environment can give you more freedom to pursue your own ideas and academic interests. Carolyn Sachs would have had a better chance of practicing the profession she loved if she had gone to her second-choice school instead of her first choice. Impressionism, similarly, was possible only in the tiny gallery that virtually no one went to, not in the most prestigious art show on earth. Dyslexics are outsiders as well. They are forced to stand apart from everyone else at school because they can't do the thing that school requires them to do. Is it possible for that outsiderness to give them some kind of advantage down the line? To answer that question, it's worth thinking about the kind of personality that characterizes innovators and entrepreneurs. Psychologists measure personality through what is called the 5-factor model, or Big 5 inventory, which assesses who we are across the following dimensions. Neuroticism, sensitive nervous versus secure competent, extroversion, energetic gregarious versus solitary and reserved, openness, inventive and curious versus consistent and cautious, conscientiousness, orderly and industrious versus easygoing and careless, and agreeableness, cooperative and empathetic versus self-interested and antagonistic. The psychologist Jordan Peterson argues that innovators and revolutionaries tend to have a very particular mix of these traits, particularly the last three, openness, conscientiousness, and agreeableness. Innovators have to be open. They have to be able to imagine things that others cannot and to be willing to challenge their own preconceptions. They also need to be conscientious. An innovator who has brilliant ideas but lacks the discipline and persistence to carry them out is merely a dreamer. But crucially, innovators need to be disagreeable. By disagreeable, I don't mean obnoxious or unpleasant. I mean that on that fifth dimension of the Big 5 personality inventory, agreeableness, they tend to be on the far end of the continuum. These are people willing to take social risks, to do things that others might disapprove of. That is not easy. Society frowns on disagreeableness. As human beings, we are hardwired to seek the approval of those around us. Yet a radical and transformative thought goes nowhere without the willingness to challenge convention. If you have a new idea, and it's disruptive, and you're agreeable, then what are you going to do with that, says Peterson. If you worry about hurting people's feelings and disturbing the social structure, you're not going to put your ideas forward. As the playwright George Bernard Shaw once put it, the reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man. A good example of Peterson's argument is the story of how the Swedish furniture retailer IKEA got its start. The company was founded by Ingvar Kamprad. His great innovation was to realize that much of the cost of furniture was tied up in its assembly. Putting the legs on the table not only costs money, but also makes shipping the table really expensive. So he sold furniture that hadn't yet been assembled, shipped it cheaply in flat boxes, and undersold all his competitors. In the mid-1950s, however, Kamprad ran into trouble. Swedish furniture manufacturers launched a boycott of IKEA. They were angry at his low prices, and they stopped filling his orders. IKEA faced ruin. Desperate for a solution, Kamprad looked south and realized just across the Baltic Sea from Sweden was Poland, a country with much cheaper labor and plenty of wood. That's Kamprad's openness. Few companies were outsourcing like that in the early 1960s. Then Kamprad focused his attention on making the Polish connection work. It wasn't easy. Poland in the 1960s was a mess. It was a communist country. It had none of the infrastructure or machinery or trained workforce or legal protections of a Western country. But Kamprad pulled it off. He's a micromanager, says Anders Östlund, a fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. That's why he succeeded where others failed. He went out to these unpleasant places and he made sure things work. He's this extremely stubborn character. That's conscientiousness. But what is the most striking fact about Kamprad's decision? It's the year he went to Poland, 1961. The Berlin Wall was going up. The Cold War was at its peak. Within a year, East and West would come to the brink of nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The equivalent today would be Walmart setting up shop in North Korea. Most people wouldn't even think of doing business in the land of the enemy for fear of being branded a traitor. Not Kamprad. He didn't care a whit for what others thought of him. That's disagreeableness. Only a very small number of people have the creativity to think of shipping furniture flat and outsourcing in the face of a boycott. An even smaller number can have not only those kinds of insights, but also the discipline to build a first-class manufacturing operation in an economic backwater. But to be creative and conscientious and have the strength of mind to defy the Cold War, that's rare. Dyslexia doesn't necessarily make people more open, nor does it make them more conscientious, although it certainly might. But the most tantalizing possibility raised by the disorder is that it might make it a little easier to be disagreeable. 6. Gary Cohn grew up in a suburb of Cleveland in northeast Ohio. His family was in the electrical contracting business. This was in the 1970s, at a time before dyslexia was routinely diagnosed. He was held back a year in elementary school because he couldn't read. But, he says, I didn't do any better the second time than I did the first time. He had a discipline problem. I sort of got expelled from elementary school, he explained. I think when you hit the teacher, you get expelled. It was one of those disruptive incidents. I was being abused. The teacher put me under her desk and rolled her chair in and started kicking me. So I pushed the chair back, hit her in the face, and walked out. I was in fourth grade. He calls that period in his life the ugly years. His parents didn't know what to do. It was probably the most frustrating part of my life, which is saying a lot, he went on, because it wasn't that I wasn't trying. I was working really, really hard, and no one understood that part of the equation. They literally thought that I was conscientiously making decisions to be a disruptive kid, to not learn, to hold the class back. You know what it's like. You're a 6 or 7 or 8 year old kid, and you're in a public school setting, and everyone thinks you're an idiot, so you try to do funny things to try and create some social esteem. You try to get up every morning and say, today is going to be better. But after you do that a couple of years, you realize today is going to be no different than yesterday. And I'm going to have to struggle to get through, and I'm going to struggle to survive another day, and we'll see what happens. His parents took him from school to school, trying to find something that worked. All my mother wanted me to do was graduate high school, Cohn said. I think if you'd asked her, she'd have said, the happiest day of my life will be if he graduates high school. Then he can go drive a truck. But at least he'll have a high school degree. On the day he finally did graduate, Cohn's mother was a fountain of tears. I've never seen anyone cry so much in my life, he said. When Gary Cohn was 22, he got a job selling aluminum siding and window frames for U.S. Steel in Cleveland. He'd just graduated from American University after a middling academic career. One day, just before Thanksgiving, while visiting the company's sales office on Long Island, he persuaded his manager to give him the day off and ventured down to Wall Street. A few summers earlier, he had been an intern at a local brokerage firm and had become interested in trading. He headed to the Commodities Exchange, which was part of the old World Trade Center complex. I think I'm going to get a job, he said, but there's nowhere to go. It's all secure. So I go up to the observation deck and watch the guys and I think, can I talk to them? Then I walk down to the floor with the security gate and stand at the security gate, like someone's going to let me in. Of course, no one is. And then, literally right after the market's closed, I see this pretty well-dressed guy running off the floor, yelling to his clerk, I've got to go. I'm running to LaGuardia. I'm late. I'll call you when I get to the airport. I jump in the elevator and I say, I hear you're going to LaGuardia. He says, yeah. I say, can we share a cab? He says, sure. I think, this is awesome. With Friday afternoon traffic, I can spend the next hour in the taxi getting a job. The stranger Cohn had jumped into the cab with happened to be high up at one of Wall Street's big brokerage firms. And just that week, the firm had opened a business buying and selling options. The guy was running the options business, but did not know what an option was, Cohn went on. He was laughing at the sheer audacity of it all. I lied to him all the way to the airport. When he said, do you know what an option is? I said, of course I do. I know everything. I could do anything for you. Basically, by the time we got out of the taxi, I had his number. He said, call me Monday. I called him Monday, flew back to New York Tuesday or Wednesday, had an interview, and started working the next Monday. In that period of time, I read Macmillan's Options as a Strategic Investment book. It's like the Bible of options trading. It wasn't easy, of course, since Cohn estimates that on a good day it takes him 6 hours to read 22 pages. He buried himself in the book, working his way through one word at a time, repeating sentences until he was sure he understood them. When he started at work, he was ready. I literally stood behind him and said, buy those, sell those, sell those, Cohn said. I never owned up to him what I did. Or maybe he figured it out, but he didn't care. I made him tons of money. Cohn isn't ashamed by his beginnings on Wall Street, but it would be a mistake at the same time to say that he was proud of it. He is smart enough to know that a story about bluffing your way into your first job isn't altogether flattering. He told it, instead, in the spirit of honesty. It was, this is who I am. Cohn was required in that taxi ride to play a role, to pretend to be an experienced options trader when in fact he was not. Most of us would have foundered in that situation. We aren't used to playing someone other than ourselves. But Cohn had been playing someone other than himself since elementary school. You know what it's like. You're a 6 or 7 or 8 year old kid, and you're in a public school setting, and everyone thinks you're an idiot, so you try to do funny things to try and create some social esteem. Better to play the clown than to be thought of as an idiot. And if you've been pretending to be someone else your whole life, how hard is it to bluff your way through a one-hour cab ride to LaGuardia? More important, most of us wouldn't have jumped in that cab because we would have worried about the potential social consequences. The Wall Street guy could have seen right through us and told everyone else on Wall Street that there's a kid out there posing as an options trader. Where would we be then? We could get tossed out of the cab. We could go home and realize that options trading is over our heads. We could show up on Monday morning and make fools of ourselves. We could get found out a week or a month later and get fired. Jumping in the cab was a disagreeable act, and most of us are inclined to be agreeable. But Cohn, he was selling aluminum siding. His mother thought he would be lucky to end up a truck driver. He'd been kicked out of schools and dismissed as an idiot, and even as an adult, it took him 6 hours to read 22 pages because he had to work his way word by word to make sure he understood what he was reading. He had nothing to lose. My upbringing allowed me to be comfortable with failure, he said. The one trait in a lot of dyslexic people I know is that by the time we got out of college, our ability to deal with failure was very highly developed. And so we look at most situations and see much more of the upside than the downside, because we're so accustomed to the downside. It doesn't faze us. I've thought about it many times. I really have, because it defined who I am. I wouldn't be where I am today without my dyslexia. I would never have taken that first chance. Dyslexia, in the best of cases, forces you to develop skills that might otherwise have lain dormant. It also forces you to do things that you might otherwise never have considered, like doing your own version of Comprod's disagreeable trip to Poland, or hopping in the cab of someone you've never met and pretending to be someone you aren't. Comprod, in case you're wondering, is dyslexic. And Gary Cohn? It turns out he was a really good trader. And it turns out that learning how to deal with the possibility of failure is really good preparation for a career in the business world. Today, he is the president of Goldman Sachs.